reading issues? Do you need to go get Reading Rainbow?
Reading Rainbow! Butterfly in the sky. I can fly twice as high. I can go twice as
high. You like scary movies?
Uh-huh.
What's your favorite scary movie?
Oh, no tears, please. It's a waste of good suffering.
I'm eternal, child. I am the eater of worlds and of children.
There's no more room in hell. The dead will walk here.
Please, God.
This is God.
You're going to need a bigger boat.
They're coming to get you, Barbara.
All right, all you movie junkies. It is time for the SLS Cast with your hosts, Matt and Tim.
And welcome one and all to episode 46 of the SLS Cast. Yes, welcome to my sultry sounding voice. As usual, I have the gift of the voice that is so wonderful to listen to on this October evening.
So, have you started taking up smoking cigarettes or anything? Because your voice is sounding pretty interesting.
My voice should be the regular dulcet tones you have come to know and love.
Well, they are more stressing the dulcet, but not the regular. Well, I wouldn't say dulcet. I get the impression that you are a large, fat man that really needs a hug. That is what I am hearing through my headphones right now.
That should be how I sound every week.
But not like an African-American.
Oh my god. Wait, I sound like that?
Yes.
It must mean that it is the Hollywood Horror Cast edition of the SLS Cast. Oh my god, I did forget that it was Halloween time. Well, I guess we're just gonna have to roll with it. We're going to be talking about the Saw franchise today during our 3 Squared for this episode. Tim has a whole bunch of fun things to say about some Saw movies, and I don't have the same Saw movies, but I've got Saw movies as well.
You saw Saw 2?
Yeah.
You seesaw?
We got some seesaw action. And then we're going to be discussing Carrie, the 2013 version, of course, and all of the Invasion of the Body Snatchers films, because there's 4 of them to talk about. That's right. Probably doesn't help that I sound the way that I sound.
But it makes it sound more interesting, though.
Thus is the curse of the Hollywood Horror Cast.
That you sound like Satan?
No. We'll never have anyone who sounds like Satan quite the way you did from when we talked about the bronies and stuff and you got your uncle that shirt.
Well, I was possessed. I mean, you have to be demonic to purchase a shirt that says Bronies Forever written and rainbow glitter on top.
But maybe we could call Zelda from the Poltergeist series and have her come in here and exorcise the demons.
I hear you guys are talking about bronies. Those are for girls.
Yeah, as it turns out that Friendship is Magic was actually designed by the preacher. So.
Sold by Kane, the Reverend.
Oh dear God, what are we gonna do? Alright, well let's go ahead and see if we can exorcise our own personal demons here and switch into regular show mode, alright. Here I feel the little curse being lifted as we
go and have some fun, maybe. Oh no, that might not sound exactly the way we want to sound.
Bring it back into the
Maybe not sound like that either. That
maybe.
Yes, this probably is how I will normally sound.
Out of context, it sounds like you're pleasuring yourself. Like, it's a good thing we are not on radio, because if somebody tuned in They were thinking, what the hell is he doing?
Oh, I have no idea. Hopefully no one will notice the playing with me side of this show, or playing with myself side of this show. And how was your week?
Went to a couple concerts the past few days. Bell X1, don't know if you've ever heard of them, really good. The Irish.
I have heard of the Irish before. They come from Ireland, I hear.
That's what they think. That's what they think. But we all know they come from gold in gold pots. And
did you just say they came from Pol Pot? Oh my god, what the hell's the matter
with
them?
From Pol Pot? See, that is definitely... Talk about crossbreeding of different types of people right there.
Yeah, but you know, it's a multicultural thing. We are very multicultural here on the Hollywood Horror Cast edition of the SLS Cast. We're actually pretty multicultural all the time. We like to offend everybody equally.
Now that you mentioned the word offensive, there is something that I heard about that actually my girlfriend brought to my attention. Matt, you have access to the internet, right?
I am right here. What do you want me to look up?
What I need you to look up at this very moment is American Apparel. They produced a shirt that is causing
their
ton
website,
of controversy.
So AmericanApparel.com?
No, well, probably not on there, but just like Google the American Apparel shirt controversy. And it should pop up. It has a very suggestive shirt that I wonder how many 17, maybe 15-year-old girls are wearing this to school now.
Oh my god, seriously? I just saw the top link story.
Yep, there should be a picture. Wow. Are you looking at the picture?
Yeah, they have the Not Safe for Work edition and the Safe for Work. Holy crap.
Yeah.
Open, bleeding.
Oh my.
Yeah, and she's touching herself during the menstrual period.
I do, however, think that the Wet Tea Power Washed Tea is pretty cool. This is a shirt that looks like you're wearing a wet t-shirt.
Is it also from American Apparel?
It is. And it is also conveniently priced at $32.
See, what's great is that this is America right here. And American Apparel is an American store because you know what? They only hire Americans to make these clothings. And they pay them at a fair price. But I wonder if they know what the hell they are making. Like some of these older women maybe. Or maybe there it could be even some children working in these factories making these little menstrual vaginal pleasure shirts. And wondering, why the hell am I getting paid to make this? This is ridiculous. So, yeah. I thought you might enjoy it.
It appears now that the score is 2-1. In favor of Tim. However, I will make sure to at some point ambush you and make the score 2-2. You're not going to know when it's coming, but it's gonna, but oh yes, one day.
I thought that would suit this Hollywood Horror Edition. However, I thought it was the Hollywood Horror Edition, spelt W-H-O-R-E. However, I think signals
yes.
got crossed.
Hollywood Horror Cast.
The genre.
Yes, that,
yeah.
The... It W-H-O-R-E-R. Horror. Interesting.
So how was your week?
Let's see. After learning about the vajayjay shirt and the wet t-shirt shirt and a new way to do a horror cast, I think my week was pretty tame by comparison. Nah, didn't really get to do a whole heck of a lot, just pretty... standard week. Got Halloween coming up. Still planning on going as Peter Griffin. Kids are still wanting to do the Incredibles thing, so one's going to be Violet, one's going to be Dash, one's going to be Jack-Jack or whatever. So we'll see how that all goes, but yeah. I guess we should probably just get right to it then, huh?
Yes, sir. We got a lot of ground to cover this episode.
Then let's do it then. It is time for...
The News!
Thinking like that, don't that give you a nightmare?
Strange you should say that. As a matter of fact, not for that reason, mind you, but I had the strangest feeling last night.
Yeah, I had kind of a lost night myself.
It's funny. The world is so different in the daylight. But in the dark, your fantasies get so out of hand.
All right, so I'm going to go ahead and go first because I'm really excited about my wonderful news here. I've got two bits of news for you this week, and they are all about the sequels, baby. As a matter of fact, leading in with baby was not an accident because we've got...
Give me some sugar, baby.
And...
Hail to the king, baby.
And if any one of you so much as touches me... That's right. We've got... Bruce Campbell confirming Army of Darkness 2. That's right, folks. This comes to us from bloodydisgusting.com. Aren't you so glad we have these kinds of discussions and stuff? Because had we not had this discussion last week, I would not have known about this website and therefore would not have found this wonderful article. Yes, so courtesy of bloodydisgusting.com, coming to us via Evan Dickinson. Last month, Evil Dead remake director Fede Alvarez told us that the original trilogy director Sam Raimi was now focused on making Army of Darkness 2. Now it seems as though Bruce Campbell is confirming both his involvement and the fact that the movie will happen. He told the crowd at Wizard World Nashville Comic Con, quote, "The last one was 22 years ago. I just haven't been racing to do it. Sam Raimi is just a little bit busy making the biggest movies in Hollywood. I used to be busy. Now I'm not. That's why I'm here." He then joked, continuing, quote, "Ash would have to stop occasionally from chasing some deadeye to catch his breath. Maybe we could do that, I guess. That would be exciting. Fight in a walker. That would be all right. Hit them with my cane. Fake them out. Have a heart attack. Distract a zombie. I like it." End quote. However, that's not all, folks. But the whole thing isn't a lark. He ended up on a more serious note and apparently came clean. Quote, "All right, sir. The answer is yes." End quote. The article concludes with, "I'll be the first one in line." And, Evan, that is a lie, sir. I will be the first one in line. Last but not least from me, again, with the sequel news, it's about that guy that you don't want to say his name three times in a row. And no, I don't mean Candyman looking into a mirror. 'Cause I'm not going to lie, that shit creeped the fuck out of me when I was a teen. No, I'm talking about the original three-time name under its baddie.
Beetlejuice. Beetlejuice. Beetlejuice.
It's showtime.
Beetlejuice. Ladies and gentlemen, a sequel to Tim Burton's Beetlejuice has been in development for a while, that's right. But according to GeekTyrant.com and courtesy of Joey Power... Tim Burton returning to direct Beetlejuice 2. Yes, this is something I've been reading up on for a while. Michael Keaton has really wanted to do this since the very beginning. They had stuff immediately in development, but the script never panned out. Burton got pulled away. Keaton only wanted to do it with Burton. Keaton's been kind of talking to people all along, and it really came down to Keaton and Burton both saying that if they got a good script, they would love to do it. The thing is that they're not trying to do a direct sequel involving everyone. It's going to actually take place, at least the rumor mill is going, that it's going to take place 27 years later. Why? Because it's been 27 years since the first movie. So I'm very excited because this is going to open the door to everybody who wants throwbacks to the original Beetlejuice will be able to have that. They can control the cameos any way that they want and be able to reach that, but they don't have to have it exactly tying into that one. Remember, Beetlejuice has died at the end of the movie again because he was pretty much brought back into the world of the living, but then has died and he's head shrunk. So will he be head shrunk at the beginning? Maybe he's on a quest for 27 years to fix that. Who knows? But yeah, so this is going to be exciting. From the article, a sequel to Tim Burton's Beetlejuice has been in development for a while. The script for the movie was written by Seth Graham Smith, author of the book Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Hunter, and the screenplay for Dark Shadows. Last we heard, the project was a top priority for Warner Brothers and Burton. Michael Keaton was even excited about reprising his role. Now, according to a source at Schmoes Know, Keaton will return as Beetlejuice and Burton is looking to direct it, which has kind of been the case all along. I always assumed Burton would direct the sequel anyway, and apparently he was even thinking about dropping out of his Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children project set up at 20th Century Fox to do it. He shifted his schedule around, though, and is going to end up making both films. I guess the biggest news here is that the movie is still moving forward with the two major players we want involved with the film. From GeekTyrant.com. And thus concludes my news. Take it away, Tim.
Beetlejuice. So, a bit of news that I have been wanting to talk about for a few weeks now. And it pertains to Quentin Tarantino. And, you know, everybody, because of who he is, what kind of movies he makes, and how many people really love this fellow's movies, I do too for the most part, they're always curious. A lot of people are just curious as to what movies he likes and what movies he chooses as his favorite flicks of a given year. Recently, Quentin Tarantino's top 5 favorite flicks of 2013 so far, that list has been released. And let me name off a few here, and I believe Matt will find this pretty interesting, because there are particularly 2 movies on here that we both do not like. First up is Afternoon Delight, Jill Soloway movie, Before Midnight, the Richard Linklater movie, Blue Jasmine, the Woody Allen movie, The Conjuring, the James Wan movie, Drinking Buddies, Joe Swanberg movie, Francis Ha, the Noah Baumbach movie, Gravity, the Alfonso Cuarón film, This Is the Inn, the Seth Rogen, Evan Goldberg comedy, and then finally, the last 2, Kick-Ass 2 and The Lone Ranger.
I never thought that I would ever disagree with Quentin Tarantino on anything. Turns out this is the second time, because I didn't like his choice of, in the Kill Bill movie, that all-girl Japanese band, the 5-6-7-8s or something like that, whatever they are. The yeah, didn't like them. So it turns out I've been disappointed twice. But tell us, please tell us, he gives some kind of explanation for this.
He doesn't go into any explanation about the Kick-Ass, his choice in Kick-Ass. However, in an article via IGN.com, they talk about an interview he had with The Playlist, and it's during this interview where he talks about Batman, where he says Batman isn't interesting, but that's a different story. However, he defends liking The Lone Ranger, and he says, quote, "The first 45 minutes are excellent, but the next 45 minutes, a little sophoric, or soporific. It was a bad idea to split the bad guys in 2 groups. It takes hours to explain, and nobody cares. Then comes the train scene. Incredible. When I saw it, I kept thinking, what? That's the film that everybody says is crap? Seriously?" He continues, "That being said, I still have a little problem with the film. I like Tonto's backstory. The idea that his tribe got slaughtered because of him, that's a real comic book thing. But the slaughtering of the tribe, by gunfire, from the cavalry, it left a bitter taste in my mouth. The Indians have really been victims of a genocide, so slaughtering them again in an entertaining movie, Buster Keaton style, that ruined the fun a bit for me. I simply found it, ugly. End quote. Maybe I have to watch it again. I don't know how that'll change anything, but who knows. I have another passing to announce. Ed Lautner, the character actor, passed away from mesothelioma. He was born 1938, passed away this year, so I believe he was 74 years old. You might have noticed him in a few movies. He's been in a lot, actually. Some of his most popular roles were in The Longest Yard, the 1974 version, where he played the jail warden to Burt Reynolds. He was also in Alfred Hitchcock's Family Plot. And most recently, you probably saw him in The Artist, 2011. However, he passed away. Seemed like a cool guy. He was always an entertaining actor. He had a very interesting look to him that made him prime for villainy type roles. Again, his name was Ed Lautner, passed away from mesothelioma. Okay, so next up, writers Robert Orci, or Orci, and Alex Kurtzman, they have been tasked, I guess, by Universal to pen the drafts of the remakes of Van Helsing and The Mummy. They were also heading the Sleepy Hollow TV show project as well, so if any of you guys like the show, or like the writing of the show, it was made by these 2 guys. And maybe you agree with what they are wanting to do with the classic Universal horror monsters in future movies. In a recent interview with IGN, Orci says they're looking to go make sure their lead characters move over into other movies. That is right, and he says that, quote, there's an interesting thing that could happen at Universal, where they have this amazing library of their old monsters and these kind of heroes, and the idea of trying to create a universe, Van Helsing, and we're also producing The Mummy for them. We're kind of imagining updating these kinds of things. You don't want to just make remakes when you're doing a thing unless it's worthy of being a remake. But when you have an idea for something that can actually be made different and yet be true to what it was, we just had a notion of how to make it modern and have a slightly different tone. It's not going to be just a remake. End quote. By the sound of this interview, it kinda seems like they're gonna be moving towards the Marvel DC comic supergroup movie line, movie storyline, or whatever. So you might not just see a Dracula movie or a Frankenstein movie or Wolfman movie, but you might see a Dracula, Frankenstein, Wolfman featuring the Invisible Man movie. But who knows? What do you think, Matt? Would you like to see a Universal horror classic monster supergroup movie?
I don't know. This sounds like the movie... it's gonna sound... It's Captain Redundant Man. Male Redundant Man. This kind of sounds like a movie version of the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, which is kind of already a movie. The difference is that these people were based on books in the movie, whereas this movie is just about movie characters on their own. I mean, I get it though. The formula that was 10 years in the making for the Avengers paid off in spades. So, why not? I just think that it's one of those things that... It's not one of those, well, if they do it right kind of things, of course. No, no, they are going to have... They cannot miss anything. They are going to have to get origin stories in place, and they're going to have to be able to blend them. And... The biggest question is these are, for the most part, already all bad guys. Dracula is typically a bad guy. The Wolfman is kind of a bad guy, basically a bad guy. The Mummy is a bad guy. All these people are bad guys. Who the hell are they going to fight? I mean, what is Lone Star? He's just going to show up out of nowhere, being chased by the plaid fucking vehicle from Spaceballs, and they're all going to turn and fight him?
A couple years ago, they were supposed to be making a Monster Squad remake, but I'm not too sure what happened with that. I mean, maybe this is taking its spot or taking its place. And you know what? There's a reason why these Universal horror classics are classics. These are classic monsters, well-known monsters. And I'm not too sure how they can capitalize on the horror classic unless the tone and aesthetics are more like the horror films of the 30s and 40s. So I'm kind of with you in they should just leave it alone and do something original, but if they just go for that good old-fashioned classic Todd Browning feel, I might be down for it. I don't know. We'll just have to see.
I don't know. I just really think that this is kind of weird.
Well, I have an idea. How about make something a little bit more original? Or just maybe create a new character? Just do something else. There's a reason why they're Universal classic characters.
But that's just it. How many times have we rebooted Batman? How many times have we rebooted Superman? Look at even now with the Justice League thing that they're doing. How many times have you seen Spider-Man's been rebooted already? It's just literally people are the studios in their infinite wisdom. I know that it's audio, but please feel the air quotes that I'm using right now. Just want to do something. They don't want to do anything original. God forbid they should do something original. Jesus fucking Christ. I don't see this. Look, I don't see how they can pull this off, because there's no way, because they would literally have to get every single aspect exactly dead on right for anybody to even appreciate it, much less think it's good. it's just not worth doing. I literally do not see this. I hope it doesn't happen. Honestly, this one, I hope it doesn't happen. I don't mean to hold back. I'll tell you how I really feel. I'm just joking.
All right, next up. So, currently filming for Transformers 4, Age of Extinction, is underway in Hong Kong. And apparently, according to rumor, Michael Bay was attacked with an air conditioner unit and or punched in the face by one of two Asians that approached him.
My hero.
Since that rumor was leaked, Paramount came out and made a statement, which is available for your reading pleasure. But what I think is more interesting is Michael Bay's statement. And this is what he said. He says, quote, "Hi, it's Michael. Yes, the stories being passed around is not all true. Yes, some drugged up guys were being belligerent asses to my crew for hours in the morning of our first shooting day in Hong Kong. One guy rolled metal cars into some of my actors trying to shake us down for thousands of dollars to not play his loud music or hit us with bricks. Every vendor where we shot got paid a fair price for our inconvenience, but he wanted four times that amount. I personally told this man and his friends to forget it. We were not going to let him extort us. He didn't like that answer. But an hour later, he came by my crew as we were shooting, carrying a long air conditioner unit. He walked right up to me and tried to smack my face, but I ducked through the air unit on the floor and pushed him away. That's when the security jumped on him, but it took seven big guys to subdue him. It was like a zombie in Brad Pitt's movie World War Z. He lifted seven guys up and tried to bite them. He actually bit into one of the guard's Nike shoe. Insane! Thank God it was an Air Max. The bubble popped, but the toe was saved. Then it took 15 Hong Kong cops in riot gear to deal with these punks. In all, four guys were arrested for assaulting the officers. After that, we had a great day of shooting here in Hong Kong." End quote. They were trying to hit him with an air conditioning unit. That totally sounds like a Michael Bay movie right there.
Of course it sounds like one. All we need is for the air conditioning unit to explode.
And in slow motion as well.
Ooh, yes. I forgot about the slow motion part.
Yes. And this piece of news is pretty interesting. Greg Silverman, Warner Brothers President of Creative Development and Worldwide Production, recently spoke to Variety about Batman vs. Superman, the upcoming next Superman-Batman movie. And he said this, quote, "Wonder Woman is an amazing character. I think it's a great opportunity both for box office success, but also to have an amazing, powerful female superhero." So it sounds like that Wonder Woman may be in the next Superman movie. Should that happen? We're already getting a new Batman for the audience to get used to. Would it be wise to throw in Wonder Woman on top of that? Because we gotta get used to one character, and we also have to get used to the audience, when I say we, has to get used to the dynamic between Batman and Superman. It just seems like throwing in Wonder Woman is just a little too much. However, I will say that the idea is interesting, because that would mean one less origin story. We wouldn't have to worry about a Wonder Woman origin story where it takes an hour and a half to figure out how Wonder Woman got her powers, for her to figure out who she is, and to establish who her enemies really are, other than her inner struggle of overcoming her ability, or her inner struggle of accepting her ability. So, I mean, the idea would be nice, but maybe not a Batman-Superman movie, throwing her in there just for the sake of there being one less origin story. It's a little too forced. So the movie Doctor Strangelove, Stanley Kubrick's dark comedy classic from the 1960s about the Cold War. What would you think if I said that Kubrick wanted, or actually toyed around with the idea of making a sequel to Doctor Strangelove? Actually, let me answer that for you. Why? That is just one of those movies that just needs to be left alone. But, you know, this is pretty interesting. This is from an article from thedissolve.com, and they say that, quote, "Strangelove director Stanley Kubrick actually entertained the idea of a sequel called Son of Strangelove. He worked on the concept with Strangelove co-writer Terry Southern, but rather than direct it himself, he was interested in Gilliam leading the project. According to the Zero Theorem filmmaker, Gilliam said that, I was told after Kubrick died, by someone who had been dealing with them, that he had been interested in trying to do another Strangelove with me directing. I never knew about that until after he died, but I would have loved to. In quotes, or in quotes. It's just an interesting idea, or an interesting little factoid, because obviously the movie will not be made because Kubrick is no longer around, but it's just interesting that he would want Gilliam to have made the movie. And you know what? I could totally see Gilliam making that movie. I mean, just the goofiness, the stylistic directing, especially the use of black and white and the type of cinematography they used on Strangelove. Oh man, Gilliam could have had so much fun doing a sequel. Alright, so my last bit of news. Paramount Pictures and Darren Aronofsky are currently working on the new Noah movie, as in Noah's Ark, the biblical tale. However, the movie will not be based off the biblical tale of Noah. Noah will be more so like the very first environmentalist. That is right. We will look at this as a natural disaster movie, but not a tale of biblical proportions where God is in the picture and there is an overarching message to it. And this is causing quite a bit of controversy because nobody really knows how this movie will do, because the movie, the budget is over $100 million, like $138 million or $150 million. A ton of special effects, state-of-the-art special effects. But because of this move in choosing the type of tone and the story elements of the movie and removing the biblical aspect or much of the biblical aspect, would that not alienate a core Christian audience? A lot of people aren't going to be too happy.
How the hell would he do that, though? I mean, it's a Bible story.
All right, so here, let me read the Hollywood Reporter article. This came out on October 15th, and this was an article entitled Darren Aronofsky, Paramount Spar Over Noah Final Cut by Kim Masters. And it says, quote, God gave Noah some very specific instructions on how to build an ark, but it seems there was no such clear voice of authority when it came to the making of Darren Aronofsky's epic movie based on the Bible story. Multiple sources say that the test screenings of various versions are producing worrisome results. Aronofsky and Paramount have been at odds over the versions of Noah that is set to be released on March 28th. It's not clear whether Aronofsky, whose most recent film 2010's Black Swan grossed $329 million worldwide and won an Oscar for star Natalie Portman, has held on to his right to Final Cut. Aronofsky and his reps did not respond to requests for comment. But Paramount Vice Chairman Rob Morris says that the film, which stars Russell Crowe as the seafarer, is going through a normal preview process, and the result will be one version of the movie that Darren is overseeing. In recent weeks, the studio has held test screenings for key groups that might take a strong interest in the subject matter, in New York, in Arizona, and in Orange County, California, which is for the general public in Orange County. All are said to have generated troubling reactions. But sources say that Aronofsky has been resisted to Paramount's suggested changes. Darren is not made for studio films, says a talent rep with ties to the project. He's very dismissive. He doesn't care about Paramount's opinion. The auteur director of films including The Wrestler, Pie, and Requiem for a Dream, Aronofsky hasn't been associated much with big studios or big effects pictures. But with Noah, he's in deep with both Paramount is splitting the cost, now past the original $125 million budget, with Aaron Mitchell's New Regency. The use of visual effects has been so extensive that in some scenes only an actor's face is in the final image. The film relies on effects to create the flood, of course, but in addition, Noah doesn't feature any real animals. And the article goes on, beyond the visuals, a major challenge has been coming up with an exciting third act that doesn't alienate the potentially huge Christian audience. In the Bible, Noah and the Ark's inhabitants survive the flood that destroys the earth. Some in the faith community already have expressed skepticism about the result, especially after writer Brian Godawa, in October 2012, obtained a version of the Noah script and posted his summary online under the heading, Darren Aronofsky's Noah, Environmentalist Wacko. Aronofsky has in the past described Noah as the first environmentalist. Among his conclusions is that Noah will be an uninteresting and unbiblical waste of $150 million that will ruin for decades the possibility of making a really great and entertaining movie of this Bible hero.
Okay, well, that makes a little more sense. So basically, he's trying to tell an eco-tale versus God said that because of the sins of the world, I must take it all out. I personally don't care. This doesn't sound like a good movie either way. I mean, did anybody see Evan Almighty? I mean, come on.
Right, and also, like, they say that he's wanting to show him as the world's first environmentalist.
That sounds stupid.
Something that should be
on a
t-shirt.
I don't think they should make this movie anyway. But I really think it's completely retarded to make it about... I mean, because the whole point is that you've got a movie that is biblically based. So you're automatically going to more or less put non-religious folk on, and especially activists against Christian religion, right or wrong, kind of on a high alert with a Bible movie. And then you've got the whole point of the Bible movie, which is that people of faith, Jewish people, Christian people, whatever, agnostics, Unitarian even, hey, why not, would look forward to a movie about something from the Bible. So you are now pissing everybody off by making the core, your most ideal core audience, who generally believe I'm trying to say this in as nice and an even tone as possible. Not because I'm trying to be offended, but really just trying to be fair to both sides here. The audience of people on the religious side generally do not subscribe to overarching themes of ecology and having the green movement kind of pushed into their sphere of enjoyment, especially when it comes to entertainment. So you're hacking all those people off to make people who might generally be already on edge about a Bible movie to begin with somewhat less. It just seems like you're just flirting with disaster because then everybody's going to hate the movie for a whole bunch of different reasons.
Yeah, and it's a big budget movie. It's $125
million. Yeah. So, I gotta say, I really don't understand. I do not understand this at all. I just,
But I really do like Darren Aronofsky, and despite him veering away from the biblical text, I'm still in the arc with him. I mean, I love a number of his movies. Not all of them, but... So, I'm kind of looking forward to this. I'm kind of excited to see what he did different with the story of Noah.
But I guess, I mean, I think the one quote in there about it's kind of a thin story and they're trying to expand it, that is such an understatement here. I mean, there's nothing to do. God got mad, told the dude to build the boat, sent animals to go on it, flooded the world. End of story. I mean, So, okay. All right. But we will have to wait and see, won't we? Because this is happening one way or the other.
Yes, so. If it ever gets released.
Okay. That's all right. We got to the bottom of it.
Yes. That's probably enough news.
Okay. Well, then let's get right into it then. It is now time for 3 Squared. Yes.
3 Squared.
Ah, yes. All right, so 3 Squared, we're doing our favorite horror franchise. But not to cheat it, we're going to talk about our 3 favorite films within our favorite horror franchise.
No.
And as I alluded to earlier, Tim and I both picked the same franchise. And it was not a collaboration. This was just one of those things where we both felt strongly about it, and it's going to show because...
No, he got my email yesterday. He saw I was doing it, and he thought...
Oh, man. When I came up with this topic, I already had Saw in my head, so...
Well, who saw first?
I'm older than you, so I'm going to assume me. There is no logic to that. don't worry about it.
Makes it sound like I was in preschool or something whenever the first Saw movie came out. I was in high school. I was hip.
I'm hip. I'm with it. I'm cool. I have no idea. It's 2004, so...
Right. Yeah, I was in high school, baby. Or, I mean, dude.
Yeah, so we both picked... We did, however, both pick the Saw franchise. And I think it's kind of fitting because, especially with our discussion last week about the state of horror, I think this really kind of goes to show that we believe what we say. And we have both chosen a franchise that most recently, I guess as a franchise for sure, kind of redefined horror in a commercial state. These movies have made a ton of money, but not just because the studios were beating it to death, but because in its own way, and they're not all great movies. There are definitely some weaker ones in this franchise. And judging by our picks for these movies, you will see that we disagree on which are the strongest movies in the franchise. But they told a story, and they told a whole story, which I thought was really cool. It's something that you don't see, especially as something gets further and further along, how they're able to more or less close off each movie, but still continue a story, and not, for the most part, leave anybody hanging. So yeah, I'm very excited about this to talk about it. Tim, do you want to go first, or do you want me to go first?
Do you want to play a game? Hello, Mountain Tim. I want to play a game. This game is called Three Squared. Picking your three favorite Saw movies. Begin.
It's the best I can do, I'm sorry.
Do you want to see your families? Finish the episode.
I went first for the news, so why don't you go ahead and
Yeah, guilt me into it, why don't you? It's fine, you go.
Okay.
You go warm up, do some rubber baby buggy bumpers off to the side. My favorite Saw movies are, I put Saw 1 and 2 as together in one section.
There is no cheating. Pick one now. One or two. One of them's got to be better than the other.
I'll go with the second one. But Saw 1 is still better than the other. It's just, I think these other movies get overlooked because of how good Saw 2 is and how prolific, I suppose, Saw 1 is. That I also picked Saw 4 and Saw 6. And let me tell you why. So Saw 1 came out in 2004. Saw 2 came out in 2005. Saw 4 came out in 2007, and Saw 6 came out in 2009. Saw 1, again, like I said, I think it's a very... It's a movie that defined the genre of horror of the modern generation, I believe. It's unique, very low-budget movie, but it was just cool. There was, like, a cool mystery to it. There was just a neat, breathy, airy quality, gritty quality to it that I don't think anybody was really expecting at the time. Especially to how gruesome the movie is. I mean, the movie, at least the theatrical version, wasn't really as much gruesome, but it really alluded towards a lot of stuff in the description. And, oh, I have to cut off my leg! Ah, oh, and you hear the thing going, and you know he's cutting off his leg, but you really don't see it. You might see the first little cut, but... And it had a great twist ending. It provided the perfect, creepy setup. And the sequel raised that bar, as well as overcome the problems and the flaws that the first Saw movie had. It wasn't as hokey. It was a little bit more, I don't want to say believable, but it was more of an immersive experience, Saw 2 was, I thought. Saw 2 had great pacing, and it established the intrigue of the series. I mean, knowing how good the sequel was, I think it caught a lot of people off guard that there's a possibility that this series might have some longevity to it. And by God, it did. I don't think anybody thought there would be five more movies after the sequel. So it was great. I saw Saw 2 at the movie theater on Halloween the night it came out, and I was blown away. The ending, I mean, I assume that those who care to listen about Saw right now have seen it. Just, I love the idea of Saw 2 wrapping up pretty much where the first one ended. And nobody knew that was going to happen. And like I said, it just provided the groundwork for the continuation of the saga of Jigsaw, or the legend of Jigsaw in all of his crazy, all of his goofy antics that he does to peoples. Now Saw 4 came after Saw 3, and I personally thought Saw 3 was a little too slow, and it wasn't my cup of tea, so I wasn't too sure what to expect. And I don't think anybody really knew where, how the hell were they going to continue the story if Jigsaw dies in Saw 3? How are they going to do that? Somehow they did it. And they did it by continuing his legacy. And also what I loved about Saw 4, and the story of it, for those who don't know, is that a cop, name is Daniel Riggs, has an obsession with saving people's lives. So Jigsaw puts him through a series of tests to help him realize how to truly save a life. And the movie has a great twist. And I just love how it really pushes the audience into wanting the characters to succeed. Because what I liked about it is because Jigsaw is dead, it was the beginning of the next half of the sequel movies. You have the establishment of Hoffman, of Agent Hoffman, who was going to be the one that succeeds after Jigsaw. He's taking over. He is continuing the legacy. And you don't find out about this until the very end of the movie. And I just love it because nobody, throughout watching this movie, I had no idea what was going to happen. I mean, at first, you kind of think that, oh, is Jigsaw going to come back? Is he miraculously going to be alive somehow? Even though we know for a fact he is dead at the end of the third one, because there's really no faking getting a saw to the throat, especially in a movie like this. So they did something really cool and unexpected with the Jigsaw legacy, and it all began with Saw 4, the continuation of Jigsaw. Now, Saw 6, again, came out in 2009. This was the second to last of the Saw movies. It was a little bit more political. It dabbled a little bit on the insurance aspect, the insurance companies, and how a lot of people just really don't like them. And I kind of like how they incorporated it successfully with Jigsaw's character. And I thought it had a really good setup as to why he was putting these characters through the ringer. And the movie, again, Hoffman sets up a series of traps for an insurance executive. And it turns out that the insurance executive, whom is being tested, actually denied Jigsaw insurance coverage due to his cancer. Yeah, there's the corniness of it, the standard corniness that all the Saw movies has, but I don't know, it's just, again, this is just another movie where it steps away from the run-of-the-mill Saw storylines and all the gags. But the twist endings kind of went on to become more ridiculous as the movies went on. However, I felt that the fourth movie and the sixth movie were not quite ridiculous. Again, like I said, they're still a little bit hokey at parts, but you know what? It's still a good story. It seemed like they took a little bit more time in the writer's room to really craft a good movie. So therefore, the twist effect was actually pretty good, and it wasn't like a crazy twist at the end of the movie. It was more of like little twists throughout the movies. And that's what I liked. It wasn't trying to reach out to have a ridiculous revelation at the end of the movie, but instead they took the time to craft something new and craft a character and create new aspects to a character and their motivation throughout each individual movie. It escapes the routine. And really, in conclusion, to wrap up my 3 squared, I like these films because they strayed away from the Jigsaw story, and they created new characters and scenarios that made it feel fresh and unique. And with a lot of movies, even remakes or reboots and sequels, if you've been listening to the show long enough, you might know already, that I appreciate that. I appreciate when a movie or when directors or creators or whatnot take the time to actually do something a little bit different from its predecessor. And that's why I chose Saw 2, Saw 4, and Saw 6. Because to me, those are the freshest and the most unique Saw movies that were made. Opposed to the first Saw movie, which of course is great, but that's the original. And that's all I got.
Okay, so for my 3 Saw picks... Saw flicks picks, ha. All right, I'm going with the original Saw, okay, from 2004. I am going to be jumping in also with Saw 3, 2006, and then Saw 3D, or Saw 7, depending on who you talk to or what you want to say. It's also known as Saw the Final Chapter, from 2010. Now, Saw. This is simply, as Tim had mentioned before, this was genre bending. This, even though it was very low budget, it was so creatively done that it was something that no one had ever seen before. I mean, this is basically a movie that made, good lord, its budget was roughly $1.2 million and it made over $100 million at the box office, so there's that for you, right? And we have the introduction of Jigsaw. And of course, directed by James Wan. And there was just something about the way that the movie played out. It was played out in such an original way, in such a way that had never been, that you'd never really seen something done. There was definitely the creepy factor with the pig mask thing that they had going on. Then of course you have the gore porn factor with the reverse bear trap and everything. It was the relentless murderer aspect, but then you, as the story plays out, you realize that the murderer isn't exactly someone who, A, should be trifled with, but B, is not just on some random bender. And while they are torturous in their execution, there is method to the madness. It's really interesting to watch the character interaction. I thought this was definitely one of the more cleverly written horror movies that I'd seen in years, but not because of the skill in the plot execution and everything, but basically because it was interesting to see how they delved into motivations for characters and what they did, why they did, or why they did what they did. And then, of course, when the ending gets exploded here for you and you see Jigsaw stand up off the ground, and as a fun little point in filming, that really was Tobin Bell laying on the ground. They did not use a dummy. He laid there for the whole fucking shoot, so props to him for doing that. Your mind is completely blown. It was one of those things where, for me, you never really saw it coming. And it wasn't because they were intentionally trying to trick you. It was because the way that the movie was paced and the way that the movie was leading itself simply led you to conclude what you thought you already knew. And this becomes the basis for the franchise. What you think you already know is not what's actually happening. And much like his nickname of Jigsaw, and much like his method of helping people, again, with the air quotes, I hope you're visually, you know, you can feel the visual, to basically become reborn and truly understand what it is to appreciate life, that becomes the whole thing, is how far will people go to truly make people understand how valuable life is. And yes, some of it gets lost. I personally, like, five is one of those where it kind of loses its way a little bit. For me, two, while definitely a solid entry, also seems to kind of lose its way somewhat, although it does pick it up by the end of the movie. And you just kind of see this whole story moving and arcing out as it goes, which is why, again, I think that when you jump ahead and you get to Saw 3, you do understand just exactly how, even though one aspect of the story can end, again, as was mentioned before, where John, who is Jigsaw, dies, that does not necessarily mean it is the end of the entire story. And I really, really thought that it was interesting how, again, this is one of those ones where the story of the movie follows this guy named Jeff, who is basically lost his story is he's lost his son in a car accident, and he's mad at everybody, and he's let his life kind of go crazy because of what he feels is the killer getting a raw deal. And so you see him having to go through this huge ordeal, but the whole plot of this movie isn't about him. It's about Amanda from the first movie. You then begin to see just exactly how all these pieces come together, these seemingly disparate pieces come together to start forming a larger and larger and larger picture. And this is just one of those ones where it's almost like a story within a story within a story, where you kind of get to see the summation of Jigsaw,
You get to see how good these movies can be at interlocking from things that you would never have thought possible. And then, of course, keep the gore porn factor in, keep the silly scare factor in at certain points, and then, of course, always with the creepy doll, and yet carry on in the form of Amanda. Finally, though, for me, I have to say that 4, definitely very good. 5, okay. And 6 was a solid entry, too. I have to agree with Tim on that one, that 6 was a pretty solid entry, which is why I know that that was his last one. But for me, my final pick is Saw 3D, or Saw 7, or Saw the Final Chapter, whatever you want to call it. Me, I call it Saw 7. And while the movie definitely seems to be purposely going over the top, it's going over the top because they are once again trying to show you that while the story comes to a close, you finally get to see, again, the summation of virtually everyone who has been involved in the franchise, even those who didn't make it all the way through, how they played into completion of this story. And I thought it was just a brilliant little twist at the end to bring Carrie Elwes back. It's the one person who you completely would not expect to have made it. And yet then you get to see how that story plays out as well, and how the effects of Jigsaw carry on in both the good and the bad, and how his plan always seems to work itself out. And again, lots of over-the-top stuff here, but it's the way that they still manage to very cleverly work in things from way far back in the series and blend them into virtually a seamless finale for this franchise. And that is why I think that this is the stronger movie versus 6. In terms of filmmaking quality and execution of production elements and stuff, 6 is technically a stronger film. But damn, I'm sorry, just for me, 7, what a fucking way to go. And that is why, for me, Saw franchise is definitely my favorite horror movie franchise. I guess for now, who knows, there might be another one. And that is my 3 Squared. Next time on 3 Squared, well, you're just going to have to wait till next week, because we return with Masterpiece Discussion on the SLS Cast, where we are going to be discussing Colin Briggs' article from MovieMezzanine.com entitled "An Inquisition for Our Readers: Does Rewatchability Equal Excellence?" I think that this will be a very interesting discussion that we will have.
I do agree.
So, until then, we will just move on to the movies!
Or, better yet, let's get into
This Week's Films.
Yes, the movies. That's my version of lightning crashing. Sounds good, doesn't it? So we have the Invasion of the Body Snatchers series. So there are 4 movies in that series. And then we have the 2013 remake of Carrie. Do you want to start with Carrie or end with Carrie, Tim?
Let's start with Carrie.
All right. Let's see here. I guess we'll just trade off. I'm going to give you time to revel in what I perceive to be your hatred of this movie. Good. Good. Let the hate flow through you. I am, however, going to go ahead and talk about Carrie first.
I will revel.
All right. So this here is the 2013 remake of the 1976 flick Carrie. This one, however, is directed by Kimberly Pierce and stars Chloe Grace Moretz and Julianne Moore versus Sissy Spacek and Piper Laurie, respectively, for their roles of Carrie and the mama. I gotta say, for those who don't know the story, I can honestly say at least one
one positive thing comes out of this movie. People will see the movie. People will once again be familiar with the phrase, it's just like Carrie at the prom. So I guess that's good. There's one good thing, and that'll kind of be current again, so we can maybe eke out another 40 years of that. This is a movie based on the Stephen King novel of Carrie. And again, Carrie was the first novel by Stephen King. It was his first published novel, but his fourth novel that he wrote. And it revolves around a girl with telekinesis who is raised by a crazy-ass woman. In the book, she is not a religious nut job. She's still a nut job. She's not a religious nut job. In the movies, she is. This is definitely... And then, of course, she has problems she's made fun of and then decides to have a temper tantrum that destroys a small town in Maine. This is one of those movies that is a pretty faithful remake in terms of content. They do a few things that are a little bit closer to the book than the original movie, and they do a few things that are definitely from the movie. It more or less follows the pattern of the movie, but throws in a little bit more from the book. The interesting thing that I will say was the modernization of the story, where this is a girl that is getting made fun of, and just like she's made fun of in the book, and then she's made fun of in the Sissy Spacek film, they make fun of her here, but of course they update everything, and there is actually cyberbullying going on. So I thought that was kind of clever, that they were able to do that to make it definitely something that will relate to today's teen audiences. So I thought that was pretty cool. There's also a really cool effect that is going on with the telekinesis that plays out in Carrie's pupils, and I thought that was pretty cool as well. So there are definitely some technological things where they've been able to improve. Definitely some story elements that they have made current. That being said, this movie is really a little bit better than okay, and not quite that I liked it either. I had said that I was going to just be nice and round up to 3 stars, but I just, the more that I think about it, I really can't. This is 2.75 stars for me on this one. The acting is pretty good. Julianne Moore does a pretty interesting job of playing a nut job who is into self-mutilation and everything. But I really think that they were not taking themselves too seriously. But in terms of the dynamic of Julianne Moore and Chloe Grace Moritz's characters, that they were just trying too hard to recreate that scary dynamic that was so much better done in the 76 film. Between Piper Laurie as the mom and Sissy Spacek as the thing. I gotta say that regardless of acting ability, though, I personally prefer the fact that we actually have a teenager playing the lead instead of a 27-year-old woman playing the lead. And then there were actually some surprising notes of hidden talent coming out of Sue's boyfriend, Tommy Ross, played by Ansel Elgort. But, I mean, aside from that, it just kind of pretty much plays out just exactly as you would expect and still kind of leaves you wanting a little bit more. Yeah, so this, for me, is just a 2.75-star movie. A little bit better than okay. Didn't quite say that I liked it. I think if you are someone who's into horror movies in general, I think you'll probably check it out anyway. I think that most teeny bopper kids will get a pretty good scare out of it, especially if they're not familiar with the original Carrie film. My biggest problem, and this is something that has transitioned from the book and the movies, is that Carrie gets covered in pig's blood. Now, I don't think that counts as a spoiler because you see, in the movie poster, she's covered in blood. And then, of course, in the movie poster for Carrie in 1976, she's covered in blood. So you get the idea that at some point she's covered in blood. Well, my problem is that this stuff is pig's blood that's been set up ahead of time. And I don't know if anybody's ever noticed this before, but blood coagulates before it dries. Now, the thicker the pool, the more it coagulates. So you get this kind of like pokey skin, right? And that's what I would have to think, that a big, huge bucket of pig blood would just fall like
a huge gummy bear just kind of walking out of this bucket, you know, and just kind of eat, and then would fall, and instead of splattering and covering, would probably just kill her. And then the bucket does, man, in the ensuing chaos, does manage to fall and hit somebody else in the head. But it's empty now. And yet that actually does kill somebody, depending on if you're reading the book or watching the 76 movie or this movie. Ooh, a little bit of mystery. Watch this one and figure out which one it is. So that's really the biggest thing that's always bothered me about this, is that there's just no way that the blood would actually have done that. Perhaps maybe they could have used paint instead, but I guess maybe that's not as whatever. So I have digressed a little bit further than I meant to. 2¾ stars. There you go. Tim, it's all yours, sir. Knock yourself out.
This is not a horror movie. I don't even think the original Carrie was a horror movie. I thought his was more so of a tragedy than anything else. I mean, mainly, I really do think this story is a tragedy, because it's absolutely sad that it's a story about a girl who wants to be accepted and loved and liked, yet she gets bullied and harassed constantly. Therefore, she inherits these powers, which she is not only a victim of that ability, but those powers also take over her in a certain way, to where even though if she's confused about something, she'll act upon that confusion, and therefore the end of the movie happens where everything just completely goes to shit and doesn't end well for numerous people. However, there are many horror elements in the original movie that didn't quite carry on to this movie. For a movie that caught my attention last year, once I heard about the remake of Carrie, it was going to be based more so off the book than the original movie, I was pretty excited. I was thinking that it would be pretty cool. At the time, I didn't see the movie. I actually went back and finally watched the movie here a few months ago, and I absolutely loved it. I felt that the movie still holds up today. Definitely with bullying, I think it paints a pretty accurate representation of how bullying was whenever I was a kid as well. Though I was never bullied to that extent, I was put through the ringer a few times in junior high school. There are obviously more ruder, cruder, and meaner bullies out there, and just how they represented that in the opening scene of the 1973 Carrie was just absolutely spot on. Oh, it was haunting, it was terrifying, it was horrible. So I was hoping that some of that would carry on to this movie, but it doesn't. And the result of this movie was just pretty lame. But the movie isn't absolutely horrible, but it's not good. I mean, the hints of goodness only come from those moments that were originally crafted with love in the original movie. For example, the relationship between Carrie and her mother. To me, it worked better in the original movie because of how straight that, I forget the actress's name, but who played Margaret, her mother, just played the character. How Julianne Moore plays the mother in the new one, she goes just up and down, and I just didn't buy it as much, but I'll get into more of that here in a second. Instead of this being Carrie based on the novel by Stephen King, this was more like Carrie practically based on the same exact movie as the 1976 Carrie movie. Therefore, it's nearly impossible for me to review this movie without comparing it to its 1976 predecessor.
How do you think that it's not like the book? Because they put key plot points from the book in this movie that were not in the original Carrie.
Some of it,
and
but
the
they
original
followed,
novel is based...
Right, but they followed most of the stuff that happens from the first movie. The ending that the first movie came up with, they followed that ending. I would have loved to have seen something completely either original or just go more off the book. And instead of like focusing on some more of the stuff that the first movie left out, that is really important and that is good, and that establishes, for example, the character of Sue, I think that's her name. They touch on her having a baby at the end of the movie, but it's just wasted. I mean, that whole thing is just wasted, and it seems like everything they take from the book was wasted, and it just felt like there was just so many opportunities that were missed. Now, I thought that the remake lacked nearly everything, a connection being one of them. Now, how can one connect with a character who's being bullied because of her looks and of her social ranks when she's being portrayed by Chloe Grace Moretz, who is both very pretty and quite charming, and who happens to be the ugliest student among a very fashionable and good-looking student body made up of models. Now, in the original movie, Sissy Spacek, who, yes, as what Matt was saying, she was 26, 27 years old, portraying a 17, 18-year-old girl in high school, but she played Carrie White as a real-life, awkward teen facing these traumatic real-world high school situations with somewhat normal-looking people who are behind the criticizing as well as the ridicule. And it's because of this that I cannot buy this torment that Moritz's Carrie is being put through. And I certainly don't care about how it's affecting her emotionally. And again, going back to Sissy Spacek's Carrie, it's just how she played the character. Her hopes were brought up, and then they were just completely let down, and then just all builds up to the very end when the pig blood is on her. And I think the terrifying part of that movie is just seeing her eyes wide-eyed and just piercing, the white piercing through that blood-soaked face was just absolutely horrific. And it is that buildup, and I'm not saying it's missing that moment, but it's missing that extra nudge that this story absolutely needs for it to be as effective or for it to actually be the movie that they are going for. But this movie also lacks in tone. What is this movie trying to be? It feels like one of those teen high school movies from the late 90s with bits of horribly conceptualized violence and crappy-looking CGI blood. That's right, they used CGI blood through most of the movie. Especially the bucket of blood on the head, a lot of that was CGI. Does not look real. Where's the terror within the drama? The scary aspect of Carrie shouldn't be derived from the violence and cheap horror, thrills, or even tropes, but instead from the sick relationship between Carrie and her mother, Carrie and her relationship with the school, as well as the student body, and the relationship between who are considered the villains and their plans on completely destroying Carrie's reputation. I felt that the first hour and 20 minutes of this movie was made only as the build-up to its climax. That is it. It is only during the conclusion when I actually started to feel something for the character. But even that is for the wrong reasons. Instead of watching in horror as Carrie is driven into complete madness, the audience is cued to cheer as Carrie uses CGI props as killing devices. I mean, I was hearing people laughing and cheering as she was slaughtering these people. Very well, the movie could have been going for a totally different tone to the movie. It could have been that kind of movie. Maybe they thought of, well, you know, we're gonna put aside going really delving into the character and how emotionally horrific and horrifying this situation is, but we're just gonna replace it with, oh, we're gonna let her go out with a bang. And she does, with CGI and everything. However, the people making this movie were serious about making an emotionally impactful remake where the audience will actually feel for the character. But there's a lot of contradictions to what they were saying that this movie was going to be to how it actually is while watching it. There's not any seriousness or sadness taken or felt towards the character of Carrie White. This isn't even a morality tale, because there's even very little time taken to show the buildup within Carrie, and there are really no lessons to be learned because the characters are already either too evil to begin with, or too fluffy at best. Which doesn't say much. I mean, this could be a movie about relationships. But despite there only being a handful worth mentioning, and those relationships that do work don't go hardly anywhere, the only thing you get from Carrie and her mom is that her mother is a religious psycho, and Carrie just so happened to come about at the wrong time. But then there's the mother flip-flopping between anti-everything to loving her. And these emotions are played as polar opposites, and to me, it just didn't really work out as an emotional tool for the character. Bottom line, I really didn't buy the movie. they should have focused more on the book, or took more cues from the book, and kind of did more of a book adaption, other than kind of going back and taking a lot from the movie. I mean, they even took some of her clothing, her 70s clothing, and I gotta say that she didn't look like a sheltered girl. More so, she looked like a cute little 18-year-old hipster. Because, you know, hipsters dress like that. I see a lot of people dressing like that. I didn't find any joy in it. And this doesn't really feel like a movie that was directed by Kimberly Price. And Kimberly Price directed Boys Don't Cry. She directed Stop Loss. Very personal type movies dealing with relationships and strong characters. And I just thought there was missed opportunities. So I give this movie 1 star. I wanted to like it. I like the people that are in it. And I really dig the story. So of course, I wanted this movie to succeed.
We are going to jump into the Invasion of the Body Snatchers series. We have the 1956 science fiction film. Then we've got the 1978 remake. Then we've got the 1993 loosely based version, but still pretty much the same thing. And then finally we have The Invasion, which is the 2007. Did you notice that the last two movies just went Body Snatchers, The Invasion, instead of Invasion of the Body Snatchers? Okay, so the 1956 version, the one that started all... Now, interesting thing with all of these movies is that they all share one thing in common with the book that it's originally based on. And that's the very interesting difference to the end of the book. So hopefully one day y'all will read the book and find out what that difference is. I gotta say, let's see here. The 56 version, again, for being from the 50s, and I'm taking all that into account, for me, 3.5-star movie. Very solid effort. I thought that this was pretty well acted for its time. I definitely thought that the special effects were pretty cool for its time. And I think that while there are other people who probably enjoy this movie more than I did, who will give this 4 and 5 stars. And again, this was actually, it's on the National Film Registry. But I think it's because more of the fact that it was so culturally groundbreaking at the time, and it inspired so many different kinds of movies, and of course the remakes that have come along the way that keep, people are trying to innovate it and trying to keep making it new and fresh, and that in and of itself ought to tell you why this is important. But for me, this was just this is 3.5 stars, so definitely I liked it. I it's right there in between liked it and really liked it. I think, though, that really the only drawback of this movie is that I think that they were really building to something cool, and I would have liked to have seen the ending expanded just a little bit. Now, I don't think it needed like 10 or 15 more minutes or anything like that, but I really think that probably just a few more minutes, and I mean literally like 3 to 5 more minutes, just to kind of see how they were going to try and play it out to see what ultimately could have happened, probably would have made this movie even more amazing than it already was, and so much better than it already was. 1978, for me, 5 stars all the way. This was the first one that I ever saw. This, is, of course, is, again, 1978, so this one's actually got Jeff Goldblum, Leonard Nimoy, stars Donald Sutherland and Brooke Adams. Just a fantastic way it plays out. The suspense is amazing. The special effects were really cool. Just creepy enough to just kind of keep you up at night, and definitely, even today for me, don't like watching it by myself. This is actually the only one of all 4 of them that I made sure to rewatch again during the day. The other ones just I watched whenever I got a chance, got around to it, but I made sure to watch this one during the day. And again, this is a longer one. The 56 version was about approximately 80 minutes. This one was nearly 2 hours, so just a fantastic movie, and I loved the way that they actually had this play out in San Francisco using health inspectors. So it was kind of interesting to see the way that they build these dynamics of the main characters, and how you actually got to see it from a civilian government side instead of the slightly more militaristic version in the first one. So for me, 5 stars. I love this movie. It's one of my all-time favorites, so I might be biased. Moving on to the 1993 version, this one is heralded by critics as being a lot closer to the book. Roger Ebert particularly liked this one, and I thought this was a pretty solid one. I think that this is, For me, it's a 3-star movie. They definitely tried to do some pretty cool stuff with this. They tried to make it militaristic along the lines of the first one and a little bit closer to the book. But also, they tried to really bring a familial aspect to it. This was more about how families can work and the interplay there. So that was kind of cool, but I don't know. I just felt like it was a little bit tired and that they kind of went cliched with it by the end. I wasn't really happy with the pod people in this particular version, and I was a little disappointed with the ending. So I did like it, though. So 3 stars on this one. Last but not least, well, actually last and least, but we're going to go chronologically, I guess. So this is the 2007 version. It's called The Invasion, and it stars Nicole Kidman and Daniel Craig. And for such typically pretty high caliber actors, although what Nicole Kidman was thinking of in The Paperboy, I have no idea. Again, maybe that was the whole, as long as I get to piss on what's-his-face's face. This is just... I don't know. Tim might be able to fill you in a little bit more. He said that there's a reason why. But this movie, for me, 2 stars. Did not like. Special effects were okay. I just really thought that the pacing was off. It was kind of like the direction was bad. And despite that these are 2 good actors, there wasn't much going on in their performances, even versus pod people. Yeah, I don't know. The ending was weird. Felt like the ending was contrived. I did not like this one. I will say that they really did try to modernize this one and really bring it up to a story that could be told today so that it wasn't exactly like the previous 3 movies, but I mean, it's ostensibly telling the same story. It just did not do it well. And so 2 stars for me. So, the 56 Invasion of the Body Snatchers gets 3.5 stars. 78 version of Invasion of the Body Snatchers gets 5 stars. Body Snatchers from 93 gets 3 stars, and The Invasion from 2007 gets 2 stars. Ready, go!
Okay. Alright, so Invasion of the Body Snatchers, 1956, 5 out of 5 stars. Absolutely love it. Every time I watch it, I'm still surprised by how cool it looks. It's just a classic, or I guess I could... It's a cult classic. It is the classic of the cult classics. I love how mysterious the movie is, and its presentation is absolutely perfect. The use of shadows and the music, that the lower key notes that I... This might even been the first movie to really ever use the... whatever that's called in music, I have no idea. But it's effective. The build-up to where Miles and Becky... or in that mine at the end of the movie, and all of a sudden they hear this beautiful music. God, it's just, it's intense, and it's absolutely beautiful. It's a beautifully hopeful moment that even with current movies, you don't even see. I mean, I guess I could even say that maybe the Carrie remake needed something like this. It just had that moment that this movie needed just to add that extra oomph to the story and just to make those characters more so relatable to the audience. Very powerful. It's just a very likable movie that's chock full of paranoia and suspense. Now, the director's Don Siegel, he directed such classic movies as Dirty Harry and Escape from Alcatraz. Of course, I mean, this guy makes quality movies, and this is one of them. So again, 5 out of 5. Now, the 1978 Invasion of the Body Snatchers, a well-acted movie, but the pacing is an issue with me. The movie runs a little too long, but it's an ideal remake. They take settings and events from the original movie, but instead of completely copying what happened, they make something fresh and their own. I mean, this is a very creepy flick that doesn't go overboard and isn't in the slightest campy. But again, the Body Snatcher story works best with a shorter runtime, which would then make it a tighter film. I gave this one 4 out of 5. Body Snatchers from 94? I thought this was a very intriguing movie, and it has some great character moments in it as well. I mean, and again, I forgot to mention that the 78 Body Snatchers has that same moment from the original at the end, but they use Amazing Grace. I guess if you've never seen the original movie, it's super effective. But however, what they did use from the other movie that I absolutely love was the use of Kevin McCarthy. as he's running out, and he basically does his scene from the ending, or the beginning and the ending, of the 56 Body Snatchers. They'll get you, they're all around, they're here, and then he gets hit by a car, which is pretty much what should have happened to him at the end of the original movie. But it happens in the 78 version, and it's great. But back to the 94 movie. Like I said, it's a very intriguing film, great moments, especially when the plot and the events just completely, when they take off, it's just fascinating. The movie really goes into not only the paranoia, but how devious the aliens can be. So I give this one, as well as the 78 Body Snatchers, 4 out of 5 stars. Now the invasion. Before I mention my critique of it, I will say that this movie was originally directed by Oliver Hirschbiegel, who directed the movie Downfall about Hitler's last days. This was his big American movie, The Invasion. However, when Joe Silver, the producer, he saw the movie and he was bored by it. The studio, Warner Brothers, didn't care for it. So what did? They brought in the Wachowski siblings to come in and rewrite new scenes, additional scenes, and then they brought in James McTeague, who is best known as directing V for Vendetta. They brought him in, and he directed, I think, 10 extra days of shooting, which is quite a bit of reshoots and extra scenes and whatnot. They did this to tighten up the movie, make the action more actionier, and make it more of an exciting pick. Now, honestly, I kind of think the Oliver Hirschbiegel film probably would have been better, probably filled with more nuances than this one, but definitely more accurate when it comes to the body snatcher mythology. And it's obvious that this movie was made by various people, because tonal wise it's all over the place. That is my main concern. That, and plus the aliens, they're supposed to show no emotion whatsoever, but yet they get pissed off in the movie. And lastly, what's so good about the other movies is that the 56 movie is an attack on McCarthyism. The 78 movie is an attack on, like, Watergate and keeping tags on those that are not like you, kind of playing with the government a little bit. And what I thought was very interesting is reading Roger Ebert's review of Body Snatchers, which, again, what Matt said, he absolutely loved the movie, thought it was the best out of the series. He said that this movie could have even been about the AIDS crisis. But The Invasion is not culturally significant, has no undertone to offer up. I mean, they hint Iraq a lot and the war going on over there, but they never really address. There's nothing to address. There's really no meaning behind it. And I think that's overall what hurts the movie completely, is that there is no spark. There is no thought behind it. But yet, the movie is shot beautifully, which annoys me. 2 to 2.5 stars out of 5. So, there we go.
Very cool. Which means we are now ready to talk about the flicks for next week, which are going to be Captain Phillips, Maniac, and Antiviral. And I think that's about the end of it, is it not? Are we down to the end?
Yes, sir. Spiel on.
All right.
Well, the regular scheduled music that you listen to in our podcast is provided to us, as always, by our music partners, Cries of Solace. You can check them out at criesofsolace.com. You can also go to reverbnation.com, myspace.com, and facebook.com/Cries of Solace. For the additional horror music, that is provided by Rising Game, The Other Side of the Door, and Ghostpocalypse 8 Epilogue, courtesy of Kevin MacLeod at incompetech.com, and that is licensed under Creative Commons.
And in addition to the horror music provided by Kevin MacLeod, we also have additional horror music provided by Technoax and Sam Haynes. Technoax, spelled Technoxe, number 59 was the track. That is what we used for our opening discussion, and then we used Sam Haynes' Carnival for our 3 Squared. And you can find Sam Haynes' music at www.hauntmusic.co.uk. So the SLS cast wishes to thank both Technoax and Sam Haynes for allowing us to use their awesome music.
Yes, and of course, we are
the SLS Cast. You can check us out at slscast.com. You can send us an email to theslscast@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter at theslscast. And, of course, you can subscribe to us on iTunes. Don't forget to go to Facebook and search us there as well. And until next time, this here be Matt saying that thanks to Ethan Hawke, I get to say this. Some people burn out. And some people, like Clint Eastwood, he was a wild international movie star in his 30s. And he's doing the best work of his life now. Go figure.
And this is Tim saying, Happy Halloween.
Ooh, yeah, that too. Reading issues? Do you need to go get Reading Rainbow?
Reading Rainbow, butterfly in the sky.
Thanks again for listening to the SLS Cast with your hosts, Matt and Tim. Remember that you can find us at slscast.com, at the SLS Cast for Twitter, also on Facebook, and you can always subscribe on iTunes. Thanks again for listening.